An unsilent woman speaks up for herself and for change. She uses her voice and owns her story to create culture and community, fearlessly and unapologetically. Hi, I'm Purva Miller. Join me as I talk to trailblazers and changemakers about questioning the status quo, building success, and creating a life that truly inspires. So grab a cozy beverage of your choice and get comfy. This is the Women in Our Town podcast. My guest today is Kari Nixon. Kari is an assistant professor at Whitworth University. Her research focuses on social understandings of death, disease, and community. Her academic book, Kept From All Contagion, Germ Theory, Disease, and the Dilemma of Human Contact, was published in June 2020. And her mass market book, Quarantine Life, From Cholera to COVID-19, What Pandemics Teach Us About Parenting, Work, Life, and Communities from the 1700s to Today, comes out in June of this year. Kari is a medical humanist and has been studying infectious diseases in quarantine to try and understand their impacts on the human spirit. This was an eye-opening conversation for me because so much of our collective focus over the last year has been about managing and containing the spread of COVID-19. And I think because of that, in some ways, we've forgotten the very real consequences this disease has had on our collective psyche and our way of life. Terms like the new normal have become mainstream, and we've mostly accepted the new normal pretty quickly. But I wonder if there is still this cognitive dissonance between the reality of disease and how we think we can manage it. As we stand on the precipice of change with a new administration in the White House, I think this is a timely conversation to examine what gets attention and why, how we need to reframe our understanding of epidemics and pandemics, and what are some of the lessons we can learn for public health and for our future. I am here today on the Women in Our Town podcast. I'm joined by Kari Nixon. Welcome, Kari. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, absolutely. I'm so excited to talk to you. What has this past year been like for you? Are you the only person in the world or one of a handful of people in the world that is kind of looking back on this and saying, you know what? I'm not completely shocked like the rest of you that this is what has happened.
Yeah. I don't know how many others there are like me out there. I think to some extent for the last 10 years work as a scholar working on social anxiety and reactions to epidemics and also secondarily the impact of quarantine on the human spirit and our morale. I guess it sounded like a niche specialty for 10 years, but academics always think, especially in the humanities, we always think that what we're doing is always relevant or we wouldn't do it.
Right.
But yet I think, yeah, specifically once this all happened, there was sort of a bunch of us in the infectious disease medical humanities field that were like, yeah, like we've always been saying it's when, not if. And particularly in the Western world, it's a great privilege we have to have been able to believe that we were sort of past infectious disease as a society.
Right.
I mean, you hear people saying similar things, I think, with like, oh, the work of feminism is done, or the race work against racism is done. And there's been sort of a movement to be like, no. We're still vastly working on these things. And it has felt for a long time that nobody wanted to hear me when I said that about infectious disease, or that to say a similar thing about infectious disease was treated as sort of being alarmist or conspiratorial, when in fact, I won't speak for other medical humanists. I felt that it was akin to saying the work of feminism is not done, the work of racism is not done, because saying that we're past infectious disease in America or England or Canada is setting up this really unquestioned binary that we're somehow I wanted to say immune, but then that was a little bit too on the nose metaphorically. That we are somehow not susceptible to the things that we know the rest of the world is susceptible to. It's the same sort of, I don't know if you want to call it white privilege, but first world privilege, I think, that we talk about when we talk about white privilege or male privilege. To me, it's part and parcel of the same thing, but I couldn't, you know, for years, I couldn't get anybody to think, to agree with me. I had trouble getting jobs because people felt like what I was doing wasn't relevant. Even highly trained academics, they were like, you know, that's not really what we're dealing with. And I was like, well, that's the problem. That's your privilege that's making you think that, you know, this doesn't matter. And it's only a problem of those people over there, which is itself the problem of your privilege.
Exactly. No, 100%. And, you know, it's funny because I've been thinking a lot about infectious diseases and like the last, you know, say 20 years that sort of seems kind of more relevant to our time. SARS, MERS, swine flu, Ebola, Zika. It's either, like you said, happening somewhere else. Ebola and Zika, they're typically happening in say developing countries or tropical countries. And so we don't feel like we're, even though they're devastating diseases, where we feel immune to them. And with SARS and MERS, I think it was, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just that compared to COVID, the fallout to our daily life was less impactful. And we felt that they're containable. And maybe we have a lot of faith in authorities to manage these things. But I agree that maybe we've gotten a little too comfortable and we wear a cloak of invincibility when it comes to pandemics in the Western world. This kind of it hits home for me in some ways, because I wasn't born in Canada or the United States of Canada where I live, or the US. I was actually born in India. And I mean, if you're going to get sick anywhere in the world, you know, there's more than a billion people in India. There's a lot of communicable and transmittable diseases there. So I've had, you know, as a baby born in the 80s, I got polio vaccines. I got, you know, things that people here have never really been vaccinated. People my age have never been vaccinated for, because they were like, well, polio was eradicated. And I was like, well, no, I actually know people who are like, you know, my parents' age who have had polio and are, you know, have lived with disability because of it.
Yeah, there's an interesting way in which, so one of my favorite articles ever that is published in an edited collection that I co-edited. So I was sort of the project manager, but I didn't write this article. They make the really provocative claim that ideas of epidemics versus endemic are social constructs. And I'll define them for you in just a sec. Social constructs, you know, meaning that we sort of imagine these things or we've made up the definition socially more than mathematically. And we tend to think of epidemiology as a mathematical discipline. So endemic, of course, you know, we know what an epidemic is. That's an outbreak. Endemic means a disease is sort of naturally prevalent at a certain stable level in a population over time. So the seasonal flu is endemic for Americans. And they make this really great claim that more than being about mathematics and numbers and curves, endemic versus epidemic has to do with how much Westerners attend to or care about the disease. So when we label something endemic, we're very much able to be like, that's just how those people over there, those others with a capital O, like they just live with those things. Conversely, you know, when we had, for instance, the 2014 Ebola crisis in America, I mean, we had 11 patients and, so we treat it much differently. And you bring up polio. That's a great example. Polio has been endemic to human society. I mean, mathematically, since the ancient world. But when it hit white middle-class America in the mid-1900s, it was suddenly an epidemic and there was this urgency to find a vaccine. Yeah. And so these concepts also are tied in with our own biases and our own ideas of our cloaks of invincibility, what we should and shouldn't have to, I say that in huge scare quotes, deal with in the Western world. And they have a real impact on how the disease courses run. As you say, like, you know, people, I think you said your parents' age that have, well, maybe not even your parents' age, that have had the polio vaccine or had polio in India. And it's not, in this essay, what they say is viruses don't kill people, people kill people.
Right.
And I'm very, very persuaded by that argument that we obviously, you know, not always, but in many, many cases have the tools to figure these things out if and when it matters to us. And I think when you talk about SARS, to bring it back to what you first brought up, SARS, MRSA, H1N1, we sort of lucked out in that the problem stayed away from Western shores in the way that we fantasized it would. And then suddenly when we saw a disease that the novel coronavirus that wasn't staying safely packaged away somewhere else, like we imagined it would, you know, then we got off our couches and made a vaccine, you know, like,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you are a medical humanist and an academic. What is that? And how do we contextualize that in kind of light of the novel coronavirus and what you do in light of the coronavirus?
So medical humanities in a really pragmatic way can be thought of as the umbrella discipline that houses things like medical ethics. So that's the philosophy branch, history of medicine, certainly like literature and medicine, poems about disability and sickness. Medical humanities is kind of just the broad term for that. In literature, so I'm technically trained as a literature professor, which many people find kind of surprising. They may not understand how that sort of fits.
Right.
Most people trained in literature recently, in the last few years, getting their PhD, we're trained to pick from all those disciplines. So I do a healthy amount of philosophy that I pull in, and I certainly am trained to do history. And then I do analyze novels and sort of think about the ways that authors use the imaginative space of fiction to think through bioethical questions for my work. In a more sort of philosophical sense, the way I think of the medical humanities is something that allows us to use all of those tools to consider things we might be missing in our quantitative research frameworks today. So for instance, by looking at, you know, some obvious biases or missteps we've made in the past, such as thinking, you know, taking the ideas of evolution to posit that different races were differently evolved and making sort of a racial hierarchy based on that. We now call that scientific racism, but it was deeply believed in the 1860s or so. And so what I try to do in my work as a medical humanist is say, like, yeah, it's easy to look at that and be like, oh, ha ha, those people had this obviously wrong view. But if we're not equally applying that lens as well as we can to things we're doing today, we are going to be making similar missteps. So one thing I've asked throughout this pandemic, based on my learning, is why, when we have diseases like SARS and MERS and H1N1 and the swine flu and the novel coronavirus, we always have this tendency to be like, okay, where did this start? And Porval, I'm just going to ask you, what is the answer always? Where do we always think that these diseases
start? It's the Wuhan virus. Yep. It's China.
Always, right? East and South Asia and Africa.
Yep.
It's never, never, never the Western world. And one of the questions I'm trying to shout from the rooftops is, isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
A lot of people are not comfortable with this idea. I tried to put it in some of my op-eds that I wrote, and my CNN editor, who is a great person, they were like, "This is just, we're not putting it in there. We're, you know, they don't." There's a misconception that when medical humanists say these things, that that we're trying to debunk science. And
I see.
What I want to say is I'm trying to help us make the best science we can, because, you know, not only is that, you know, to say that it's always from Asia or Africa, you know, horribly biased, But it could very well be wrong if we're conveniently getting the same answer over and over and over. And that makes our science not help us find the proper answers to vaccine development and things like that as fast as we can. So that's sort of a quick and dirty example of how I see the reframing process that a medical humanities scholar can do. It's sort of saying, like, what questions are we asking imperfectly? What are we not asking? What are we missing? And that's how and it's hard. I mean, it is really hard to break out of our box of, but that's statistics, but that's math. And I was trained, you know, I was in training to be a statistician before I went to English. And one of the reasons I left is because as a sort of hopeful 22-year-old, I thought that statistics were an infallible measure of truth. And I discovered, of course, they're only as good as the people wielding them. And so I am actually qualified to say that these things can package our own biases into them because they're only as good as the questions we're asking.
100%. I agree with you. And I think it's so easy to, the reason, I mean, at least in the past 1 year that I've been thinking about, as we all have, about the coronavirus and you know, what it has meant for us, it's easy to say that it's the Wuhan virus or the virus from China or South Asia, or Southeast Asia, where, you know, wherever virus is coming from. I wonder if it's because, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, it allows us to sort of deflect a little bit of the responsibility of our own, you know, of our own governments ignoring warning signs for years and years and years, or our own people ignoring warning signs for years and years. It allows us to as human beings, we're so quick to other, and nobody wants to think that we are part of the problem. It's easy to say that group of people, they are the ones bringing the problem. So to solve the problem, well, let's just shut down our borders and not allow people to come in, and let's, you know, let's have lockdowns, which of course we need to do to contain the virus. But at the same time, what are the lessons we're taking away from this? Is the lesson that we're taking away that this all comes from another place? And so the way to kind of avoid future pandemics is to be more insulated and more closed? Or is the lesson we're taking away, you know, we really need to start looking at ourselves? I mean, there's a lot of problems within our own communities, within our own countries. There's, you know, there's so much that can be said. And I think you said this on a podcast that I listened to where another culture, another community could look at our meatpacking districts and say, well, those are rife with problems. And it's, you know, maybe there's a pandemic waiting to happen there. Maybe there's a virus waiting to happen there. So, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on this.
Well, I think you've said it exactly perfectly. You've sort of taken what I was just alluding to a minute ago and drawn it out to, I think it's the potential extrapolated consequence of these missteps, and why, as a medical humanist, I feel it's really important to be like, hey, we could be missing a really important part of the picture. Because if the way we've identified this research question, like who started this, and that always leads to, you know, not us, then the consequence is that we think, at least implicitly, that by avoiding others, somehow we'll avoid a contagion. But what if that's not true? I mean, what if, as is obviously scientifically true, we are all capable of harboring viruses and spreading them. And so we're missing a huge part of how we could actually contain, prevent, and control disease in the future, because we've only looked at this one way. Like you said, like we think it's this false sense of security by like being insulated and closed. Okay, we've got this. But if that's not actually, if that's a fundamentally flawed answer resulting from a fundamentally flawed research question, then we've actually only opened the door for more viruses. And I mean, one thing I want to add too is like, another way to look at this is, to what extent is the idea of identifying a patient zero a fundamentally Western idea anyway, from an individualistic culture? I mean, I only know Western cultures. I will not actually make like explicit statements about other cultures, but I wonder all the time, what a more communalistic culture would they, if they weren't influenced in their sciences by Western science and like overly doing Western epidemiology, would they even be asking about one person starting a disease or one country or one city? Or would they think as I think makes a lot more sense, that these things are fluid and porous as our cellular membranes, as our corporeal and skin-based membranes. Like, we are all like open to these, you know, flows of microbes, and we can all carry them. And I wonder how that would change the way we even talked about epidemiology, you know, but that's a question that, as far as I know, isn't being pursued. And it's, you know, what if the answer is there somehow, but like, we're not pursuing that because science is influenced by the way we think of humans and bodies and societies.
Right. Absolutely. No, I completely agree with you. And like anything, the information you get out is only as good as the information you put in. And so if you're not asking the right questions, you're probably ending up with flawed information to begin with. And so, like you said, it can just make the problem worse. So when we think about the novel coronavirus, the example that comes to mind is in terms of the profile of the disease and sort of the fallout and people's reaction to it, is the Spanish flu. What are some of the parallels that we can draw between the Spanish flu and COVID-19, and how, you know, the lessons that we learned or came out of it, and people's reaction to it? What is some of the parallels that we can draw, and what are some of the things, commonalities we can find in those two examples?
Yeah, great question. I think one that's been on a lot of people's minds. I cover the Spanish flu a bit more in my forthcoming book, Quarantine Life. And to be honest, I wasn't really a Spanish flu scholar before working on it for Quarantine Life. But in doing that work, I discovered so many fascinating parallels, like down to such little nuances you would never even imagine, like mask shortages and people like, I mean, now it's crafters, but I suppose in 1918, more people just sewed as a norm. But it just like everybody would just be sewing masks because they couldn't get masks to people quickly enough. The school closures, and not just the school closures, but parents wondering how their kids would catch up in school, which, I mean, maybe because I'm a scholar of the late 1800s, it actually surprised me that people had such a modern sense of schooling progress and concerns about that. Like, I kind of thought of it more of like, I don't know, parents didn't really care. Maybe that makes me sound like a bad historian, but I was really surprised about that. Some of the colleges talking about the different activities that they weren't going to be able to have is just really touching. And I did see some of the resistance to mask wearing, you know, so, and not as much as I thought I might. I thought actually it would be a little bit more, but there was definitely articles about certain subsets of the population that didn't want to be wearing masks, and that they were angry about it. And then people, the governments, local city governments, having to issue like actual penalties for people not wearing masks. So yeah, it's been really interesting. The other thing is, I think, just the massive scale of death and the sort of existential impact, which it's hard to really speak to because of that scale. It almost feels like you're lessening it when you try to put that in words. So I'm actually not going to. I'm going to, for once, stop talking and just let that horrible grief just be in a space of silence.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, kind of this segues into something that kind of struck me a few weeks ago. I read this story about a nurse in an emergency room in South Dakota that has been working throughout the pandemic. And she's seen a lot of people come in, a lot of people recover, but she's also seen people die of COVID. And she went on Twitter to talk about this. And she said that, you know, it was shocking to her to see people on ventilators, gasping for breath, unable to speak, unable to move, denying till their very last breath the existence of the coronavirus. And I read this article that said that you don't have to believe in COVID for it to kill you. How is how is this possible? Where is this cognitive dissonance coming from? We're so quick to trust doctors on so many levels and nurses on so many levels. We you know, pay so much money into our healthcare systems, as we should. Why are we then not taking that information and listening to it?
I think about that story a lot, actually. Which, I mean, just spoiler alert, means that I'm not 100% sure what I make of it, because usually when I decide I know the answer, I'm like, okay, my brain can let it go now. And right. I find her story so haunting, as I think it sounds like you do as well.
Yeah.
If it's okay, I mean, I'd like this to be less of me, you know, giving a narrative answer, and maybe you and I can like work on it together, because I haven't known what to do with such a horrifying. I mean,
absolutely.
Where my mind goes is, you might be able to predict, is just that I truly think in this case, American exceptionalism runs so deep. And oh, yeah. I think it's a tragedy. I've been working on an academic piece with a colleague of mine who works at Utah Valley University. Her name's Leandra Hernandez. And we've been working on a little piece that was originally about COVID for a journal called Feminist Studies. I think they're not going to put it in their COVID issue. I don't even know if it'll get published yet. But what right. we argue is that America is a space of meta-colonialism, where we right. came from Britain, like the OG colonizers. Yeah. And then like we were a colony, but then we instituted slavery. And so we're just like doubly colonial. And we also argue that America at that time, particularly in the 1800s, functioned as an economy of necro-capitalism. And what we argue is that, it's kind of depressing, but it's something I kind of more and more deeply believe, is you do reap what you sow, and what America has sowed is death. And and what we therefore often sow is a spiritual death of what could have been a more fulfilling existence, but we are so tied to this legacy and so unwilling to shake free from it that right. I think we have a spiritually dead culture in a lot of ways. And to me, that's what I hear with this, is like, I'm so committed to this idea that Americans can't die this way, that we're so privileged that instead of telling my loved ones goodbye with my last breath, I will just deny that this is even happening to me. That's sort of where I go. But I'd really love to just like have a conversation and sort of make more of this.
No, absolutely. And you know, you bring up a really interesting point, because I'm not American. I'm not real. Like I'm a Canadian citizen, but I haven't grown up in Canada. I wasn't born in Canada. So this idea of American exceptionalism is relatively new to me in history and political science. It's just this idea that like, well, we don't want to be told what to do. And
I'm not going to die of your virus.
Die of your virus. No virus is going to tell me that I'm dying. But there are so many. You know, why are we so willing to, for example, accept cancer? Is it because cancer is predominantly, I don't want to say a Western problem, because cancer exists everywhere.
No, this is something I talk about all the time, and I don't have data to back it up, but I will fight somebody about this because I think I'm right.
Right.
That right. We fear diseases of our own bodies in America.
Yes.
I call them diseases of the self. It's very like hoity-toity academic, but like cancers, heart disease, blood pressure. Thank you. There is this unwillingness to believe that our skin envelope is as permeable as any other bodies in America. We don't want the external threat, you know? And I think
right.
that does just align with so many American fantasies. But to answer your question about like, how do we start to root this out? I mean, maybe it sounds a little bit too simplistic, but I think it's conversations like this, because I mean, as my sort of, again, hoity-toity academic language, like necrocapitalism and metacolonialism, like I can hear a little bit super duper negative Debbie Downer about America. and sometimes conversations like this help me understand that like, the polar opposite is probably not the answer either, you know, but I think like talking right. about these, I mean, it sounds a little simplistic, but having these conversations and having someone remind me like, there is something of value to like sort of American gumption, you know, such as like, I am so American. Like the fact that I want to scream my opinion about this at everyone is very American, you know, like there is a little bit of value to that. Yeah. And I think, you know, we can all learn from each other if we were willing, if Americans, for instance, were willing to learn that there was value or possibility of influence from outside sources.
Right.
You know.
Absolutely. And I think that this past year, 2020, was so interesting to watch this almost political saga play out on so many fronts. But when like masks became political, it was just, I was like, okay, this is, you know, this is getting a little crazy now. I mean, at the end of the day, how many things do you think we do all day, every day that our governments are telling us to do? There's a social contract that we all abide by, right? You obey traffic laws. You don't just walk up to someone's car, smash their window and, you know, take their cell phone out of their car. Like there's social contracts we abide by every single day that, quote unquote, we are being told to do, because I wonder if there were enough things that weren't, you know, if there was things that were illegal, how many of us would be running red lights, as an example, because we were in a rush. And when our environment changed to now, okay, there's this virus out there and people are getting sick and people are dying and it's highly contagious. And these are the things we need to do. These are steps we need to take. It's just a new sort of environment, but I think in a way it's the same thing. We're just writing a new social contract. And that is how we've sort of built our like throughout history, social contracts are rewritten all the time to kind of, you know, to keep up with the change of culture, the change in society, the change in governance. This to me is just an example of a new social contract that we're writing.
Yeah, I actually cover this exact idea in my book about like, there are so many things, like if you just walk through your daily life, we probably don't think about a lot of them. Like you were kind of bringing up good examples, but there's so many things that we do because we have to, like, and there's probably a lot of them that we don't really like. Like every time our recycling people, they don't pick up plastic grocery bags. And every time I forget and put one in there, they put like a label, like stop putting your plastic grocery.
Uh-oh.
I mean, it'd be simpler to just throw them in there, I guess, but I'm not supposed to. Yeah. Like, you just, you know, like, there's so many things in our daily life, and this is just a new one. And in my research, again, I cover this more in the book, what I've seen over and over is that there's always this period of resistance with the new thing.
Right.
Especially when those involve things that people have to do with their bodies. Because it's more personal. I recently gave a little lunchtime chat to our local, what are they called? I think it's our local Jewish community, Jewish Family Services. We did a local Zoom chat and I asked them, they were mostly elderly women. And I asked them, like, tell me all the examples you can think of this through history where people didn't like, and they, I mean, it's everything we've ever been asked to do for safety, car seats, seat belts, bike helmets, like, I was just astonished that this is really quite a predictable reaction.
Right. And it's, you know, it's, I remember, you're so right. Like I was a few years ago, I was watching an episode of Mad Men where Don Draper is driving, you know, in the middle of the night in his convertible, drinking a beer as he's driving. And I was like, I turned to my husband and I was like, what? Like, and he's like, oh yeah, you know, people used to drink and drive all the time. And it wasn't this, let alone like illegal. It wasn't stigmatized as it should be. There's very real reasons for us to not be drinking and driving. And people came around to it. And that's alcohol. I feel like there's few things that become more contentious than when you start putting barriers between people and alcohol.
And I was going to say too, like the one thing that I do think you've hit on that's like, not the one thing you said that really stood out to me is that I don't know that I heard from groups that I've asked about this, that these things became so politicized. Yeah. I think there was resistance, but that the resistance has been drawn along party lines now that does feel unique to our moment.
Right.
And I think and concerning because the virus doesn't care like what our political leanings are.
Well, exactly. And I think this has been kind of scary because, like you said, it's unique to our moment. And if it's possible that this happened once, I think it's possible to politicize something else that is in the public interest again. And I think we need to be aware of that, and be mindful of so that we can recognize it when it's happening and say, okay, like I'm not just gonna accept what you're thinking. And it's crazy now that I'm thinking about it, because if you are falling into the camp of you don't need to wear masks and they don't, you know, or the coronavirus isn't a real thing, you're still listening to somebody else. You're still actually doing what someone else is telling you, someone who you deem to be an authority or you believe, you know, has the right to speak about this. You're accepting what they're telling you and doing what they're telling you. So is it really truly exceptionalism at the end of the day? I don't know.
Yes, and I don't want to give away too much of the book or anything, but like,
oh, sorry, I'm not trying to lead you down a rabbit hole.
It's hard because these are the thoughts I'm thinking about right now, obviously.
Right.
But I think that goes both ways, that those who support mask wearing, and I am one of them, just to be totally transparent, we're also just listening to the people that already make sense to us. And I think
true.
That maybe if we could realize that, like maybe we could have conversations, like,
yeah,
you know, I think that there is a way that I feel like my fellow progressive liberals tend to think that we are exceptional and that we aren't just listening to our own safe support base as well. But at the end of the day, humans are social creatures. And in a world where we're inundated with data, all any of us is doing is picking like what sources seem most credible to us. And so I think sometimes what I see, and this is again, my medical humanities brain, is we're asking the wrong questions, you know, like,
right.
I feel like if we could shift the lens over here, like that's the root of the problem. Like, why are certain sources being deemed credible? What are the motivations helping people? Is it a social? Is it a scientific? And these are questions that I, for more information, you can see my forthcoming book. I sort of answer talk to readers about how to have those conversations. How do you approach somebody with that? And what are the motivations that are influencing us both, so that we can start the conversation from a productive starting point instead of asking the wrong question to begin with.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. And I mean, I'm really excited to read your book. And I think it's, you know, whether you believe it or don't believe it, I think it's just important to get as much information, even if you don't necessarily agree with it, because I think that you're right. We're all in our own echo chamber at the end of the day, right? We're picking up the sources that we deem credible and we're listening to the people that, I mean, unless we're just listening for amusement, we're getting information from the people that we deem credible and sources that we deem credible. So to kind of segue into kind of where things are heading now, there's a vaccine on the way. There's much hype about the vaccine. You know, I don't want to lob softballs at you here or ask you to look into a crystal ball, but in terms of, you know, what do you think could be the like reactions? I mean, again, because I'm in an echo chamber, I think the reaction is overwhelmingly positive. But vaccines have been historically controversial as well. So what do you think would be some of the, you know, what can we expect to see over the coming months?
Yeah. Oh, vaccines kind of encapsulate so many of the issues we've talked about. And again, I cover this in my book. So I think, you know, readers who want to go get that can look forward to getting some of this history, but also the history of the ethics debates, because vaccines are sort of the preeminent thing. As you mentioned, your previous podcaster mentioned, like, what's the harm in wearing a mask?
Right.
People can imagine harms from vaccines. Yeah. And I don't mean imagine that to say that they don't do or don't exist. I mean that we can all theoretically see how that could harm you in a way that a mask really probably couldn't as much. And those debates about vaccines have existed since the moment vaccines were brought to England in the 1700s. Again, cover that in my book and what it means for our conversations today. But honestly, I go back and forth. There are moments where I was like, nobody's going to get it. I don't trust people. Not that I don't trust the vaccine makers, but I don't trust the broadness of humanity to go get this vaccine. Especially, I live in an anti-vaxxer hotspot in Washington state. In some ways, my echo chamber is a little bit like fuzzy. Like I have my echo chamber of academics that are like, yeah, give me, you know, I'll take the vaccine. And then I have my, like, the people in my community where I am like, I don't know. It's honestly, it's something that I really can't decide. I think if I had to put money, I think that averages will out and that the extremist stances are not the ones. Those are the ones we notice when any of us are worrying. We're noticing like the catastrophic possibilities. And most likely, I think that people are just going to live their lives. The majority of people are going to vaccinate as the majority of people do. And probably even some people that are a little bit hesitant may, because those people still nevertheless want this to be over.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we can only hope. It's been going on for too long. And I mean, you know, we've had lockdowns and then relaxing restrictions and then lockdowns and then relaxing restrictions. And it just becomes so difficult to kind of maintain any semblance of normalcy when you kind of don't know what next week is going to look like. So if I can kind of like pick your human behaviorist brain a little bit in terms of how we can look back on this and kind of reflect. I think one of the things that we miss, because we're so often talking about the science and the vaccine and the restrictions and the economy, which is like a whole other topic. How can we process this, you know, massive change in our world, this loss of life, this, you know, grieve the loss of a way of life? Because I think that, you know, even with the vaccine being rolled out and many countries are rolling out, it's still going to take a long time before it becomes safe and stable to do the things that we all love to do. I mean, how many people this year, and again, this is like such a privileged place to come from, how many people miss travel this year? Leisure travel, which is a luxury, actually, just leisure travel. How many people sort of miss, I mean, a lot of people love working from home, but I think a lot of people do miss going into work and seeing their friends and their coworkers and, you know, kids staying at home. And I can't even imagine what this has been like for parents. How do we process that? And how do we, you know, maybe grieve what we've lost?
That's a big question.
It is a big question. Okay. Well, you know, Cole's notes.
I think partially that this Western idea that we're somewhat impervious to disease has also taken away from us rituals surrounding mourning and grief.
Yeah.
I have a whole chapter dedicated to that in my book. So one thing I would, you know, say is like, again, I think that this is like, you know, in terms of America, when all you do is colonize all your knowledge and culture and land, like you don't really get much of your own. So like one of the ways we're having to pay the piper is that like we don't really have much of our own mourning culture.
Right.
But I would encourage people to maybe like develop a personal thing, you know, like don't steal it from other cultures, but... So at the beginning of the pandemic, I was knitting a blanket and I actually wrote about this for Yes Magazine out of Seattle. I knit like one stitch per 10 deaths globally. And I just like, I wanted to have something in my hands to feel that, because like for me, what's personally hard is that the loss of a life is just an absence. Like I can't feel that change. The change is just like nothingness. And so, and I kept knitting for like several months, but I had to stop because my hands were like, I was getting like carpal tunnel and,
oh man.
But part of that is what I wanted. I wanted to feel in my own body, like what was happening out there in the world that I could know intellectually, but not feel in my mind and heart were happening. And like, for me, that helped me a little bit. Like, and it was my own thing that I just invented, you know, whether it's lighting a candle or something. I think ritual is something we don't really have a lot of and need. And that's sort of on a personal, talking about like death, God, the loss of like our our practices and certain things that I think we all know will never go back to being the same. I don't have an answer more than anybody else. And I grieve and fear those things. I mean, I think naming it, I see a lot of people naming it. I think having conversations about it. I think also realizing that these things have long histories. Like, think about the amount of things we still have in the world that exist as relics of colonial oppression. I mean, you're Indian and my very best friend from childhood is Indian, like, and being a scholar of Victorian England, like I teach about colonization of India a lot, like little things like, I don't know, the fact that many Indian people are taught English with a British accent or whatever, you know, we have all these things.
My parents speak English with a British accent.
Tea, you know, which very oddly was
tea culture, cricket culture.
Yes. I mean, tea, which is so weird, like taken from other cultures, not actually British plants, and then like recolonized into some of the people that they took them from. Like, if you think about how, I mean, how long of a history that means that those like ripple outward effects still exist, you know, 100 years later, this is going to be something that our kids are dealing with.
Right.
And this is why I wrote this book, you know, I mean, and I talk about this in sort of the last chapters, like when the virus is over, it's not over for us culturally. And I think all I have to offer is to say that we need to be aware of that and not feel like, okay, good, good. You know, like put that away in a neat little box. We dealt with it. We got our vaccine. Like, no, like our kids will have impacts from that. And those impacts will vary depending on whether they were 3 or 5 or 15 when this happened, what part of their life altered. We are going to be fundamentally different parents, which will make the kids different, which will make them make different choices with their kids. They're going to have different relationships to goods and services. And so this is why, you know, even though the book, I think, feels kind of time sensitive, it's actually not, because we're going to be processing. I mean, another, like, we're still processing like what the Vietnam War meant for like protest culture in America. These things don't end when they end. They're things that affect like our grandparents, that affect us and what we know. And so I think for that reason, these things are important for us to continue processing. And I see my book, like each chapter has 3 lessons about how to think or converse about these issues. I think that's why it's important, because it's not going to end just when we can go back to quote unquote normal life. These things will have sort of psychological and epigenetic impacts for probably a century at least, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, what you said about not having rituals, that kind of, when you think about it, what we've actually lost are the rituals we did have in many ways. Right. And we think about it and I guess waking up every day, wrangling the kids to school, getting on a train for an hour commute to an office, that I guess it is a ritual. It's rituals that we value. Part of me wonders, is it time for some new, better rituals? I mean, there's better ways to you know, be together and you know, kind of move through life. And so,
and diseases have historically been used, particularly by authors, as a way to say, like, how can we re-envision this? Because it does that to society, where you have to be like, was this the best way to be handling childcare and employment and unemployment? You know, like, were these the best ways to handle them to begin with?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, when you think about kind of the rituals that, or maybe the new rituals that we might be creating and the new culture that we might be creating, it's, I don't know if there's been another year, and I feel like I'm pretty plugged into sort of pop culture and, you know, current events and what's going on. There's this with Gen Z as an example, already kind of the sort of at the forefront of protest culture and conversations in many ways compared to, say, their millennial counterparts or their Gen X counterparts, and definitely compared to their baby boomers counterparts. But there's now this like cohort of kids that are going through college virtually. And so their experience is going to inform their kids' experiences, and those experiences are going to inform, you know, their kids' experiences. And so, like, you're totally right. The ripple effects of these things, I see the difference, for example, as a millennial who graduated, you know, 10 years ago compared to somebody who's graduating college today, compared to somebody that graduated 5 years ago. I see so many differences in just how they're processing the world and how they think of the future and how they think of, you know, the way things are going to change and how they plan to live their lives. So,
yeah, well, we're even sometimes taught about that as we get a new incoming class at a university. Like, the one thing they taught us, which is just such a good example of what we're talking about, is that the kids that are going to college today saw older siblings and cousins our age graduate from college at the nadir of the recession. And yes, they saw people in our generation that were close to them not being able to get jobs with the college education, yep, that was supposed to help us. Yep. So they view college in a much more utilitarian sense than we did. I mean, and that's, yes, like, that wasn't even, you know, the huge, huge event that, you know, the Great Depression or a war or the pandemic is. So yes, like, this is going to affect us in ways that, like, I had never considered that they would have watched what happened to us, not necessarily in our nuclear families, and reacted. But we're absolutely going to see dynamics like that, that we may not even recognize as such for some, yeah, time.
I absolutely, you know, I absolutely agree. And I think that this is such a, it's so important to kind of reflect and think about what this past year has been. I think just from an individual space, because there are definitely lessons, but there's also, for me personally, this has sort of been a way to sort of reflect on the world that we were living in and whether that world made sense. You know, I graduated at the nadir of the depression in 2010, and that impacted my life. That impacted, career progression. That impacted the way I thought, you know, there was me in college versus me sort of in my last year of college where I'm graduating. And it was this like massive shift of how I thought about the corporate world, where suddenly the corporate world went from being this like beacon of success and something that I wanted to be part of to being this maybe more utilitarian place where it's like, okay, well, I'm, you know, this is not going to own my life. I'm here for a job, because I saw so many people lose their jobs or not get jobs when the recession happened. And so you're not really as maybe necessarily valued as you think you are, or as a worker or as an employee. And like, you have, you know, that's a totally different conversation. But I agree with you. And I think that like millennials that graduated in the recession versus slightly older millennials who graduated right before, there's totally a bifurcation there of how you think about careers and economies.
Or
and,
even like
and
delayed
work.
Home ownership, you know, how is that?
Delayed home ownership.
Home ownership, yeah, is a huge like Western value. I even like did some research on it in undergrad about like when this became a value in the post-World War II period, because those people were impacted by their circumstances. But like, how is it going to change our kids that we all bought homes a lot later and are either okay with that or not, you know, and then we pass that, yeah, value on to, you know, like,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. No, I think, you know, I'm interested to see how the next, you know, this 2021 rolls out and beyond. And, you know, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. And when I read about you, and I'm very excited to read your book, there was this moment where I was like, imagine doing this work and suddenly it becomes the most relevant work you can do. And so I knew I had to talk to you, and you know, thank you so much for sharing your insights and for you know, being part of the conversation. And you know, I can't wait for your book.
Of course. Thank you so much for reaching out. It's been a pleasure.
My next guest is Catherine Eaton, a director, filmmaker, and actor whose stunning debut feature, The Sounding, is available on digital platforms. We talk about the film that's been making its rounds on the festival circuit and ask some important questions about being different, having courage, and what it means to truly live a different life. Thank you for listening, and I'll speak to you next time with Catherine. If you enjoy the content on this podcast, you can read more stories of incredible women at womeninourtown.com or follow the conversation on Instagram and Twitter at womeninourtown.